It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today's Paul Singer. Today, we'll ask why so few people are voting for third-party candidates, even though they say they're fed up with partisan politics. First, some news on the economy. Today, the Commerce Department announced the price index for personal consumption measures rose 0.1%, and news broke that the U.S. economy grew at an even faster pace than expected in the third quarter. Here to break down the numbers and what they say about the state of our economy is Chris Farrell, Central Times economics correspondent. He's senior economics contributor at Marketplace and the author of Unretirement, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Way We Think About Work, Community, and the Good Life. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
So some kind of surprise good news for the U.S. economy today and yesterday. What's the latest on how the third quarter is shaking out?
So the third quarter came in, as you said, at 3.9%. And what that reflected in the earlier number, this was a revised estimate, and the earlier number had been 3.5%. And what the government statisticians realized, or at least in their number crunching, is that the consumer spending was stronger than they initially thought, and also business investment was stronger than they initially thought. So we've had two quarters. So in the previous quarter, the second quarter, the economy grew at 4.6%, now 3.9%. You have your unemployment rate coming down, but you still don't really have any inflation. So overall, it's an economy that is continuing to improve. It's nothing where you run out and you say, the economy is back, the economy is back. But it is continuing to get better.
Well, put this into context for us, if you can. How good is this news compared to where we've been over the long haul?
So we've had an economy that basically has been growing. Well, one way of looking at it, so third quarter last year to now, the economy is about 2.5% better. And the labor force is growing at about 2%. So that's one reason why we're absorbing jobs. But you kind of would like to have a stronger economy, a faster growing economy, in order that, you know, people who have been discouraged and have dropped out of the labor force, people who believe I can't get a job, people who are working part-time but really want to be working full-time, you know, that they can get a job and get that full-time job. So the economy's been kind of has been growing at this 2% average annual rate. And so things keep getting a little bit better, but they're not so much better that it shows up in our wages. You know, you look at your paycheck lately or talk to your friends and their paychecks, and it's like, wow, I'm glad I have a job. I'm still getting paid. This is a good thing. But we're not getting those the kind of wage increases that make you feel good about the future.
We're looking at 3.9 this quarter. What numbers would you say would start to make people feel a little bit more like shouting and celebrating?
Well, we need you know, what we need is a bunch of 4+. You know, just go on the 4+. And, you know, the thing is, if you just look at the U.S. economy, these latest numbers show the U.S. economy is gaining momentum. We are the strongest. We are a very strong economy in the world. The unemployment rate is dropping. And so I'd be sitting here and saying, look, we're going to be getting these 4% plus numbers in 2015. That's what this is telling us right now. The problem is Europe. I mean, Europe is just in this deflationary stew, and Europe's just not growing. Japan is not growing. Japan has dropped back into a recession. China's growing at over 7% average annual rate, but that's down from 10%. And so the U.S. is a beacon in the world economy, but nevertheless, the rest of the world is growing at a pretty slow pace. So is that going to keep us in this 2.5% overall average annual rate that we've been stuck in the last couple of years? That's the big question.
Right. And so, well, at least looking at the GDP over the last year in America, it's been a little bit erratic in terms of the growth. But at least is it safe to say that we are in a period of acceleration?
Yes. I think we are in a period of acceleration. There are some numbers that came, you know, and these accelerations, it's a little bit like, you know, stop and go traffic. Sometimes you decelerate. We got some numbers this morning on the capital goods side that suggest a little bit deceleration. Some of the pricing data we got on housing, maybe that's cooling off a little bit. But overall, yes, this is an economy that is stepping up into a slightly higher gear, and it's doing slightly better. And that is starting to show up, at least in the unemployment rate. It isn't enough to push up wages, which is what is really going to start making people feel better. I mean, that's kind of why there's this grumpy sense of we're really not doing that well. It's because the, you know, paychecks aren't getting fatter. But from the macroeconomy point of view and from the unemployment point of view, we're going in the right direction.
Well, so you said consumer spending and business spending were driving the growth that we're seeing this quarter, but you're also saying paycheck's not really going up. So does that mean, you know, people are spending more than they have?
Well, you know, part of it is that over the past year, so we compared to, you know, the holiday season ago, you know, there's more people employed. And so it's interesting on the seasonal hiring front. The evidence is that this is going to be one of the best seasonal hiring markets at least since 2007, before the recession. And UPS came out, and last year UPS, their peak day was 31 million packages. I mean, I find that stunning. 31 million packages. And they're forecasting that they're going to have 6 days of 31 million or more in this coming holiday season. So the holiday season, it reflects this economy. It's going to be better. It's going to be better than last year. People are going to spend more. More people are employed. People feel a little more confident. The housing market, you know, has improved. But it's not the sort of economy where you just feel, you know, I have a bright future and I can borrow some of that money that I know I'm going to get because I'm going to get a pay raise next year. People are going to be a little bit cautious about taking on debt. So they're going to be more generous and it'll show up in a better holiday season. But my guess is a lot of retailers are still going to have to cut prices to convince people to come to the stores. And overall, the gains in the holiday season will reflect a stronger but not rip-roaring economy.
Now, what about government spending? Are we to the point yet in this recovery where government spending could start kicking in and bolstering the economy?
I hope so. And, you know, a lot of that is going to be on the state and local government level. And state and local government finances are improving. And, boy, you know, you went through 2008, 2009, 2010. And, you know, there's all this discussion about the fiscal stimulus by the federal government. You know, the federal government is spending this record amount of money. But if you looked at the net government spending, it was close to zero because of all the cutbacks that were going on the state and local government level. Now, state taxes are really improving. You're seeing more hiring going on. You don't have the same level of layoffs as you did, which has really been holding back the job market. So I do think that that's one of those where state and local government had been a headwind. It's no longer a headwind and could even turn into a tailwind fairly soon.
Now, looking at some news from the Fed announcing the inflation gauge today, what do we know about what they've said about the inflation gauge and how that impacts us?
Well, you know, here's the thing about inflation. For many people, these people who, you know, kind of were around in the 70s and the 80s, and, you know, they had the sense of, you know, inflation's a bad thing. You know, high rising inflation, we don't like that. And the Fed has this target range of 2%. That's where I'd like to see the inflation rate to be. And the inflation rate is coming in below that. Now, the Fed's favorite measure is the personal consumption expenditure. And, you know, that's in the 1.6, 1.4 range, depending if you count energy or not, energy and food. And that's below 2%. The CPI is also below 2%. And so the Fed is sort of saying, you know, there's no inflation here, so we really don't have a whole lot of pressure. We talk a lot. In fact, we talk ad nauseum. We give speeches all the time about we're going to have to raise interest rates at some point. But in practice, they're not actually doing very much in terms of raising interest rates because there is no inflation.
Well, so overall, things are looking up this third quarter with the GDP growth. What is your forecast as we look ahead into 2015?
You know, forecasting is hazardous to your, as we all know, with all the caveats. You know, I'm forecasting that we have a better year in 2015 and that we're going to kick up to a higher gear and that the Fed is going to be slower than many people expect in terms of raising interest rates because it's not just the unemployment rate that needs to come down. And it has come down quite a bit. But it's also about, you know, creating an opportunity for all those discouraged workers, the people who have given up, the people that quote unquote retired that didn't really want to retire, you know, to encourage them to come back into the labor market. So I think 2015 is going to be the year that the Fed does hike its benchmark interest rate. But overall, and it's going to be a better year, and the Fed is going to be a lot less dramatic than people think. So I think a good year, better than last year, and hopefully we start really seeing the better economy and wages. So that would be my bold part of the forecast, that I think 2015 we're actually going to start seeing some wage increases.
Sounds like a forecast people are happy to hear. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Chris Farrell, Central Times economics correspondent. He's senior economics contributor at Marketplace. Coming up, President Obama may be preparing to make the biggest veto of his presidency over tax breaks. It's our weekly look at Congress. But first, Kristen Durst joins us from the newsroom with a look at headlines. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, why millennials are lagging behind when it comes to home buying and what it could say about the American dream. It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. And it looks like Republicans and Democrats may have reached an agreement on extending corporate tax breaks. But President Obama has threatened to veto that bill. It would be the third and biggest veto of his presidency. Then, even though voters are fed up, so they say, with partisan politics, data shows that this past midterm election has had the lowest percentage of voters for third-party candidates since 1998. Paul Singer joins us every week at this time to talk about the latest out of Congress. Paul, it's good to have you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, Veronica. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. So looking at some of the events in Ferguson this week, in light of past discussions in Congress, we go back to September. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul called police militarization in Ferguson out of control. There was a hearing to discuss that. Where is that conversation right now in Congress?
Nowhere. Congress, as you are certainly aware, has an exceptionally short attention span. They had a bunch of hearings where they thought that it was worth revisiting this program. This is a federal government program that basically allows, in fact, encourages the military to provide surplus equipment, excess equipment to local police departments. They call it the 1033 program. And in the end, I mean, Congress, after a couple of weeks of hand-wringing, I think concluded that there really wasn't much they could do about it. The local police departments like the program because it gets them hardware that they say is important for police safety and security and for carrying out their law enforcement mission. Pentagon still likes it, and you'd have to figure out a way to reopen a law if you wanted to rewrite it. And, you know, Congress isn't very good at reopening laws at this point. It is actually, you know, part of a defense statute, so you can't just wave a magic wand and have it go away. What has been suggested is that the outcome will be more oversight, possibly by Congress. The president has put together a group within the White House to look at the program and see if it's being managed properly. Yeah, that's it. You know, kind of a nip and tuck at the edges, but I wouldn't expect Congress to do anything formal.
In terms of things that were big and dramatic in Congress, at least from this end, Chuck Hagel, defense secretary, is out, reports saying that President Obama asked him to step down. What is your take on that move, and what was it supposed to accomplish?
Well, you know, you can look at it a couple of ways. First of all, it is not uncommon for the someone in the cabinet to, you know, move right after the elections. It happens pretty regularly. And, you know, Hagel was always kind of an odd choice for that job anyway. He's not known as a sort of square edges manager. He has always been a bit of a shoot from the lip kind of guy, which is dangerous for the defense secretary. And I think, you know, the reports are that the administration was really taking an awful lot of blame for not handling ISIS properly, the Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria, and that somebody had to take a fall for it, and they thought Hagel was just really not handling the job well. Keep in mind, Hagel also, you know, was when he was sworn in, his whole effort was about trying to reduce the size of the military to deal with a smaller budget. You know, again, a very difficult initiative to move, particularly when you're asking the military to do more and to stay on in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, I think it is some mix of it was time for him to go, people were unhappy with his performance, and the White House figured this was the best opportunity to have him leave. Now, of course, replacing him will be a bit of a challenge, but so it goes.
Well, if that move was supposed to signal, you know, the Obama administration is looking at its foreign policy and trying to fine-tune it, it seems as though that message has been a little muddled. At least it seems like there's an emerging critique right now pointing at the White House's foreign policy and saying that this is a tight, unilateral group doing the foreign policy and that maybe more changes are necessary. Are you hearing grumblings like that?
Well, I mean, that's been going on for a long time. This administration has, but again, I'm not sure this is different than other administrations, if you think back, but the criticism is this administration is a very tight circle of advisors who are largely campaign and political people, not management experts, not government experts, and that the cabinet officials are sort of left out in the cold when decisions are being made. Now, I will tell you that, as I said, the Bush administration got criticized for some of the same stuff years ago, although it was Dick Cheney is very much and has been for years was very much an expert in sort of government management. He actually set up one of the first task forces in government management in the Ford administration. So he had a lot of hands-on in the agencies that maybe Obama does not have. And Obama doesn't really have in his White House anybody doing that stuff. But nevertheless, it is true that Obama has a very tight network of advisors who have come with him from a long ways back, and maybe they're not the best people to manage big government agencies. But again, this is something that we run into with a lot of administrations, and it happens pretty regularly.
Now, moving on, it looks like the president could be getting his veto pen ready for a tax break bill, an agreement that went on apparently without White House approval on tax breaks. Yeah. Can you lay that out for us?
Republicans and Democrats, particularly Majority Leader Harry Reid's staff, were working on a tax extenders bill. This again, fairly common at the end of the year, the way Congress has been operating the past few years. Every year they have to basically extend a bunch of tax provisions. They're going to expire. And if they don't extend them, it becomes very complicated in the new tax season. In this case, apparently what happened is everybody agreed, that is everybody in Harry Reid's office and the Republicans agreed, to extend a bunch of tax breaks for corporations, stuff like research and development tax credit and a small business tax credit that lets them basically deduct anything they buy. And there was not enough goodies for the other side, that is, particularly for low-income individuals, making permanent the child tax credit, stuff that the Democrats really wanted. And the only way you get one of these tax bills done is that everybody gets a few goodies, and then you pass it. And you'll note that, of course, despite all of our concerns about spending and budget deficits, et cetera, this will be a $400 billion bill over 10 years, and it won't be offset with anything, which is, again, pretty much classic. And Obama, I guess, at the end decided this wasn't enough in it for enough sweeteners for the poor and the middle class. And so he's now saying he's going to veto it. That has sent everybody back to the table to try to renegotiate. We'll see what happens. Again, it's pretty important to business to get this thing passed. There's a lot of support for a lot of these tax cuts on both sides of the aisle. My suspicion is they'll just sort of sweeten it up and pass it.
Was this significant at all that Harry Reid negotiated this deal without seemingly the White House's stamp of approval?
Yeah, it's a little weird. You would expect Reid to be more cautious of not trying to get crosswise with the administration. On the other hand, it is possible, and I'm making this up as I go along, so I can't swear this is true, but it is possible that this is the kind of fight that Obama wants and that the Democrats want Obama to make for the new Congress, which is this is Obama saying, I'm going to veto this because it does not do enough for the middle class and does too much for corporations. That's a good message for the Democrats. They want to push that message in advance of the 2016 elections that the Republicans are all about corporations, not regular people. So a veto fight on this topic may not be a bad thing for the White House.
And on the other hand, does it maybe signal that Senate Democrats are going into looking ahead to January and feeling maybe more conciliatory, knowing that they're not top dogs in the Senate anymore?
Well, sure. I mean, you get your tail kicked, right? You argue you may not feel like you've got all that much to give. On the other hand, I mean, again, I think this is the Senate Democrats' best opportunity to make some deals now. I mean, they're going to be in much worse shape in January. At the moment, they still have all of their Democrats seated. So if they're going to get anything, get a good deal, now's the best time to get it. If the Republicans are going to give them one, they might take it. But again, I think part of this is this whole issue of, I think the Democrats and Obama really do want to make the case that we are the party of the the middle class and the working poor, and those guys, they're the party of the rich.
And finally, before we let you go, Paul, you just published a piece with new data on the number of low votes for third-party candidates. It's a bit of a quandary about why this is. What can you tell us about that?
It is. I mean, there were seven some million people voted for third-party and independent candidates for Senate and governor in 2010. This year, it was closer to 4 million. And there's a bunch of reasons for it. You know, low turnout overall, of course, is part of it. But it's also states are making it harder for independent candidates to get on the ballot. States like California have new laws where you go to a primary, everybody's in the primary, but in the general election, only the top two candidates get in the general election. That means there is no third-party candidate on the ballot at all. As one of my sources said, you know, 20% of Americans didn't have an opportunity to vote for a third-party candidate. So it's interesting. I think it's also hard for third parties to really make enough serious campaign noise to get the attention and get the votes. Sooner or later, people get to the polls and they say, "Yeah, I'm not going to waste my vote on somebody who can't win." So that's what seems to be happening.
Well, Paul, thanks a lot for being with us and have a great holiday.
Thanks, Veronica. You too. Enjoy and be safe.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time to give us the latest on our representatives in Washington. Coming up, a look at what's holding millennials back from homeownership and what it could mean for that benchmark of adulthood. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll find out why millennials are dragging their feet when it comes to home buying and what that might say about the American dream. First, we're taking a look at death and dying. Sometimes people who nearly die come back to life with amazing stories to tell. Stories about tunnels with a light at the end and visions of dead family members. Scientists used to wonder if people just made up these stories. They don't anymore, but now they're trying to figure out what triggers these remarkable experiences. To the best of our knowledge, Steve Paulson had this report on the emerging debate over near-death experiences.
To get a sense of the controversy over near-death experiences, you almost have to start with Eben Alexander, the neurosurgeon who nearly died in 2008 from a rare form of bacterial meningitis. He was in a coma for a week, and when he came out of it, he said he had proof of heaven. Because he'd been there.
I was aware of many souls dancing, and I remember choral hymns. The power behind that music, so infinite and awe-inspiring.
Alexander's account was remarkably detailed. He not only heard heavenly music, he felt a warm summer breeze and rode beside an angelic being on the wing of a giant butterfly.
And it changed everything for me. That warm breeze led me to know that this was the creative, infinite power of the divine.
Eben Alexander's account of his near-death experience got a lot of traction because of his impeccable credentials. He's a former neurosurgeon who taught at Harvard Medical School. As you can imagine, media outlets went crazy over it. He landed on the cover of Newsweek magazine and was interviewed by Oprah Winfrey, Nightline, and all the rest. But it's not so much his story of glimpsing the afterlife that's generated so much controversy. It's Alexander's claim that he had this entire experience while his cortex, the part of the brain that controls our thoughts and feelings, was offline.
He did not present any credible case to suggest that his brain had shut down.
Sam Harris, the noted atheist and neuroscientist, is Alexander's most outspoken critic.
And his brain is obviously back online because he remembers his experience. And there's no evidence he's presented that suggests that he couldn't have had his NDE, his near-death experience, when his brain was coming back online.
You're saying part of the problem is he was coming out of his coma and that's when he recalled these experiences?
Or had them. First of all, there's no evidence that his brain ever totally shut down. Even people in comas have 50 to 70% of the kind of neural activity you expect in a normal person. So let's just grant him that his brain did shut down. It's back now.
So there's a deeper issue here. Eben Alexander and other people who've had near-death experiences believe they're evidence of an afterlife or some other dimension of reality. But according to the reigning paradigm of brain science, you can't have conscious awareness, let alone visions of heavenly beings, if your brain has flatlined. So when your brain dies, your mind can't just detach itself and float away, can it?
You know, the reality is we just have no idea how the mind is connected to the body.
Raymond Moody is the psychiatrist and former philosophy professor who first coined the phrase near-death experience back in the mid-70s.
And people, when they come back from this, they think the most important thing we can do while we're alive is to learn how to love.
The Australian sociologist Alan Kelleher has looked closely at the NDE studies, and he says there are so many unanswered questions that science alone won't unpack the mystery.
I'm not sure what it is. I can tell you that the hallucination explanation is a bad one. It's got lots of holes in it. They may be a special type of hallucination, or they may be a window to the afterlife. But I can tell you that the evidence at this stage does not answer it for us.
That report on near-death experience is part of To the Best of Our Knowledge's five-part series on death and dying. You can hear the third hour this weekend, actually tonight at 6 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio. Buying a home used to be a core part of the American dream, a symbol that you'd arrived as an adult. But the millennial generation is hitting that benchmark later than earlier generations, and some just aren't as interested in home ownership at any level. Joining us now to talk about what that says about the new American dream and the future of home ownership is Jillian B. White. She's senior associate editor at TheAtlantic.com. Jillian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, where do millennials stand right now when it comes to home buying?
Well, the thing is, first-time home buyers and younger people tend to make up a pretty large portion of that group. For first-time home buyers, home ownership is down to about 36%, and that number was closer to 43% in 2005, so definitely not the same number in the under-35 crowd buying homes right now.
How does a standard profile of who millennials are as a generation affect their likelihood to buy a home?
I mean, there are definitely a lot of things that are weighing on millennials right now. A lot of millennials graduated from college, if they went to college, at a pretty bad time, you know, 2007, 8, 9, 10, right during those boom and bust years. Also, the job market has not been great, and a lot of millennials are saddled with student debt. So all those things kind of combine in the profile of a millennial and doesn't, you know, play very well for them when it comes to being in a financial position to buy a home.
So do you see this as primarily an economic story that millennials just don't have the spare money, for instance, for a down payment to buy a home, or is there more to it?
There definitely is more to it. As much as it is a financial story, it's also a cultural and social story. A lot of millennials are getting married later. They aren't necessarily looking to get married at, you know, 22 or 23, right when they get out of college. Those numbers are getting pushed back to later 20s. And, you know, that type of change definitely plays into whether or not you want to buy a home. If you're not getting married till later and having kids till later, the reason that you might have to purchase your first home is going to get pushed back later as well.
We've seen stories about the millennial generation, and you know, people are individuals, so sometimes it's hard to talk about an entire group of people like this. But one story you hear is that millennials often prefer not owning cars. They're not that interested, some say, in car ownership. Is there an extension here to be made to the housing market that millennials maybe aren't interested in some of these big ticket items? They'd rather maybe have a certain sort of freedom that includes financial freedom.
Well, part of that is true. Some of what we see when millennials kind of shy away from car ownership, that has something to do with their preference for, you know, an urban environment where they can walk to a lot of places. Millennials also place kind of a higher value on leaving a smaller footprint, so cars are definitely a part of that. Another thing that we see when it comes to the lack of desire for home ownership is that a lot of millennials have had to be pretty mobile. If they're working someplace one year, that doesn't necessarily mean that they will still have that job a year later. So they kind of need to be able to get up and go. And if you're paying a mortgage somewhere and would have to find someone to rent it or be able to sell it, that definitely hinders your mobility.
And some financial analysts are watching this right now and going, mortgages in a lot of cases are lower than rents. So what could be holding this generation back?
That's absolutely true. In a lot of places, it is definitely cheaper to buy a house right now than it is to pay monthly rent. But part of the issue with that is that to buy a house, you have to get over that financial hurdle of having a down payment, closing costs, and some pretty big one-time costs to get that lower mortgage versus rent. And for people who either haven't had any wage growth or have maybe had spotty employment since they graduated, you know, that's hard. Even on a $100,000 house, if you're putting down a 20% down payment, you're looking at needing $20,000 plus closing costs. And if you've been working, you know, a job where you're underemployed or you haven't had a raise in a long time, that's pretty hard to save up.
So is your sense then that the millennial generation will get around to buying a home, just they'll be doing it later because it'll take them longer to save? Or is there sort of a sea change that maybe home ownership isn't that big a priority?
You know, there's a lot of conflicting data out there. Economists that I've talked to are pretty split on the topic. But a lot of people think that it really will come down to when they make big life decisions about getting married and having kids. And then they'll kind of fall into the same patterns that their parents did in terms of, you know, maybe moving a little further out of a city to get a bit more space and buying that first home. So I think it's really kind of a wait and see thing. A lot of the older folks in the millennial generation are just hitting their early 30s and getting married or having those first kids. So then we'll see, you know, if renting that two-bedroom apartment in the city is still working for them or not.
Right. And as you said, with the job market the way it's been, millennials have had to be mobile, and it could be that maybe they settle into a job, do you think, and then they might get around to buying a home?
I definitely think that's possible. You know, that's one of the biggest stories that we're hearing at all levels, not just for millennials, that wage stagnation is a huge problem for people. If you're not really seeing a raise, especially one that's keeping up with the increasing cost of living, you can't really think about doing much more than what you're doing right now. So I think as people find a little bit more job security and a little bit more wage security, that'll kind of tell us what people's real desires are when it comes to where they prioritize their money.
Now, looking at home ownership as something that's not just the purchase of a thing, it's something bigger than that. At least in the American psyche, it has been. It's been a mark of adulthood. It's been sort of also one of these goals that you hit on your way to getting the American dream in your pocket. Do you think it's still seen that way as having sort of this extra gravitas, or is it something different about the way millennials are thinking about home ownership?
I think millennials are definitely going to have a different view on this. Just having sat through the housing boom and bust and seeing that something that is and has been seen as so great and the American dream can end up causing you so much heartache and strife, especially people who ended up with homes that were underwater after buying at the top of the market. So, you know, there have been a lot of studies that talk about how millennials are a lot more wary when it comes to spending money, and especially purchasing big assets. So, you know, this might be one of those things for them that they're just a little more reticent about, and they kind of look at home buying more as an asset that they need to make a decision about whether it's a smart buy or not than something that's more of an emotional purchase.
Jillian B. White is senior associate editor at TheAtlantic.com. We're talking with her about delayed rates of home buying among the millennial generation, taking a look at why that might be and what it means about one of the benchmarks of the American dream as we know it. And we want to hear from you. Are you in the millennial generation? If you can afford a home, what is it that might be holding you back from buying it? And is this still something that holds sort of symbolic weight in terms of your vision of adulthood and the American dream? And what about just the financial practicality? Is it maybe just that you haven't saved up enough for a down payment on a home? Do you want to own a home? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@WPR.org. Right now, here's a few headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now about what's been a cornerstone of the American dream, buying a house. We did see, though, the Great Recession and economy slowly recovering and millennials deferring the un-American dream of buying a home. Here to talk about why and what that means is Jillian B. White. She's senior associate editor at TheAtlantic.com. And you can join the conversation. Are you in that millennial generation? Would you like to buy a home? Is this still something that matters to you, or are there different priorities for you in your life that you think take precedence over buying a home? Or is this something that means something to you, but maybe you just don't have the wherewithal to buy that house? Call us and tell us your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And Jillian, we talked a little bit about rents versus mortgages. How do they shape up right now nationwide?
I mean, by and large, renting is more expensive than owning a home. Even in some of the priciest cities like LA and New York, it's a pretty close call for your average home as to what's more expensive, renting or buying. So I think, you know, that's saying something.
Let's go to our first caller now. John is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
So I'm a 24-year-old engineer, and I don't see home buying anywhere in the near future for me. You know, I'd say I'm relatively stable in terms of an income, but, you know, with the way the market is, I need to be ready to move at a moment's notice, and renting is really the only option for people like me.
So you're valuing your flexibility of lifestyle right now, but is home ownership something that you think of that maybe has, you know, that symbolic weight that it used to have for maybe down the road?
Perhaps down the road, but that would only be if I were to get married and have kids. And at this point, you know, I really don't see that happening in the near future. Again, it's putting those big life decisions further down the road, like
right.
Most people in my generation are.
Great. Thanks a lot for your thoughts, John. Appreciate that. And Jillian, sounds a lot like what you're seeing here, that John's waiting for those big life benchmarks, like maybe getting married before thinking about buying a home comes into the picture.
Yeah, absolutely. I think by and large, millennials who are young and single, whether they're financially stable or not, just aren't ready to commit to that level of a financial asset yet, and also just to being kind of stuck in one place.
And thanks a lot for that call, John. We go next to Emily joining us in Madison. Hey, Emily.
Hi. I'm 28, and I just bought a house 2 years ago with my husband. The big push for us was we got pregnant, and then all of a sudden it seemed a lot more important to own a house. And my parents were a big factor. They helped us out with the down payment, which was something that we had struggled with. We couldn't come up with a down payment. But they come from a generation where owning a house was really important, and they wanted us to. So they helped us out with that.
Okay, well, thank you, Emily. That's interesting. So Emily, you know, she did hit one of the benchmarks you talked about, having a child, wanting a house, but also struggling with that down payment. Is that something, Jillian, that you've seen, that sometimes it takes some extra outside help financially for young people to buy a house?
Absolutely. It's definitely a very common story. The down payment is such a huge hurdle for young people who are trying to buy. And that exact story of kind of going to one person's set of parents and asking for a little help with the down payment or it being offered is definitely something that we see a lot in people who have actually been able to buy homes young.
And also makes you wonder if the recession just sort of pushed everything down the road a little bit, marriage and parenthood, and then by association, home ownership.
I mean, that is definitely a possibility. From my understanding, the idea of pushing marriage back a little was happening a little bit before the recession anyway, so that could have exacerbated the trend. But I think it was definitely a confluence of a generation that's very concerned with achievement and career success on top of having, you know, all these financial burdens on top of them. That's definitely pushing everything a little further back.
Great. Well, thank you for that call. And we're going to go to Emily now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Emily.
Hi. I am a 24-year-old, and I have never really had a goal of buying a house. I've been fine with the notion of renting for the rest of my life, just because that's probably going to be more realistic to me. And my big fear with buying a house is that at one point, if I were to move, I would have to sell that, and I've been through the housing crash, and I know that's probably not the best financial thing to do. And a part of the American dream, I don't think a lot of millennials believe in the American dream as much as previous generations do. I think we're a lot more pessimistic and realistic about our expectations.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for sharing your story, Emily. Appreciate that. And we're hearing from Emily a pessimism about the American dream. It doesn't sound like it's as resonant for her, definitely. And she's saying for her generation, and that maybe buying a house, you know, sometimes a house is just a house. And in this case, a house is a financial burden. Do you think that's also a big strand of what we're talking about?
I think a little bit. There's definitely a certain level of trauma from the housing crisis that led to, you know, the larger recession. And that's weighing heavily on millennials. You know, I think for previous generations, you came out of school or you, you know, entered your 20s with a lot less debt and with a greater ability to buy a home and start a family and do all of these things. So there was just a lot more optimism. And for millennials, a lot of them came out, had a ton of student loan debt, couldn't find jobs. And we're facing kind of a really ugly housing market and even an expensive rental market. So that, I don't think, gives you a ton of optimism around the idea of purchasing something.
Do you think that something else would move in to fill that space where home ownership used to be? People tend to like milestones to mark different occasions in their life. If buying a house isn't one, what do you see as being a milestone that could be comparable for people?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know that people are looking for these huge kind of financial milestones like buying a house. I think for a lot of people, you know, the fact that they're pushing back marriage and weddings have become more expensive. I think, you know, for a lot of people, that's a pretty big first milestone, you know, spending money if they choose to do so on that type of big celebration. And, you know, that's getting closer to the 30-year-old mark. And that's something maybe that people are using in place or kind of as an alternative to what might have been a first home purchase around the same age.
It'll be interesting to watch what happens with this generation with home buying. Jillian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Jillian B. White, Senior Associate Editor at TheAtlantic.com, talking about the trend of the millennial generation to postpone home buying, to wait, and maybe not to buy a home at all because it's not really part of the American dream as they see it anymore. Some of them a little soured, like Emily on the American dream. You can let us know your thoughts. Send your email to talk@WPR.org, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk with a guest who explored her own background of food and family and tradition. And it all started with a quest to recreate one of her father's recipes. And we hear from former Wisconsin poet laureate Max Garland about where he finds wonder here in Wisconsin. At holiday time, it's easy to go from just fine to totally overwhelmed with commitments and obligations. Our guest walks us through one simple solution, learning how to say no. And we celebrate 100 years of 4-H. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up tomorrow morning from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow after 6 of the turkey, Benjamin Franklin wrote that while it is a little vain and silly, it is a respectable bird and a bird of courage. On this Thanksgiving Day, Joy Cardine's guest turkey expert talks about the quirks and virtues of our feathered friend and welcomes your turkey-related stories. Today is the birthday of Charles Schulz. We know him as the guy who created the Peanuts comic strip, which debuted back in 1950. His lovable loser, Charlie Brown, is still a big winner today, especially thanks to Peanuts holiday specials like this one.
What's this? A piece of toast? A pretzel stick? Popcorn? What blockhead cooked all this? What kind of a Thanksgiving dinner is this? Where's the turkey, Chuck? Don't you know anything about Thanksgiving dinners?
A clip there from the Peanuts TV special, A Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. Producer Chris Molina is a big fan. He's here in the studio. Chris, what are you looking forward to from the Charlie Brown gang?
Well, you know, I always love A Charlie Brown Christmas. It's one of my favorite things to watch around that time of year. But I'm also looking forward to 2015 when a new Peanuts movie is coming out. This is going to be a big theatrical release coming out around Christmas time next year. I'm curious to see what it's going to look like. Got some interesting CGI. There's a trailer that just came out. But without Charles Schulz at the helm, I sort of wonder what it's going to be like.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it, though. I wonder if Charlie Brown has grown any more hair.
My guess is not, but we all feel like Charlie Brown deep down inside, and I think that's why he endures to this day.
Too true. Well, thank you, Chris, for stopping by. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we take a look at the changing face of Thanksgiving shopping in an online age. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. The theme Linus and Lucy takes us to the news. This is the Ideas Network.